Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
How now, brown cow?
How now, brown mow? That was the name of a song by my band, Baby Opaque.
Oh, really?
Yep, rolling. Welcome to another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Today, our guest is Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker. How you doing, Ben?
Pretty good, Michael. How are you?
I'm good, except I've been missing the Bad Quaker show. Why haven't we been hearing it? And why are you calling in on the phone instead of Skype or Mumble?
I'm in the remote reaches of southern Alabama in my motorhome with my wife and my doggie. And we have been roaming the countryside, solving mysteries and setting people free.
Yeah, but in person, not over the internet, where it really matters.
Right.
I'm kidding. In person is good, too. But, I haven't seen a Ben Quaker show in a long time, and you recently put up something that said, "I'm on the road with connection problems." And I said, "Is that the sequel to the Jack Kerouac novel?" And apparently it is, because you, I don't know, man, I couldn't do what you're doing, not have good internet. And I think you not having good internet is frustrating me more than it's frustrating you.
Yeah, it's kind of, in many ways, it's kind of nice to be away from the technology world and just out here in the woods and everything. But in other ways, it's kind of hard to, you know, keep an audience and keep people happy when I'm not putting out a podcast all the time.
Well, I came up with an idea last night that we might do, but we both wish I'd come up with it a week ago, which is you record like 5 episodes and put them on a disc and send me the MP3s overnight UPS, and I will put them up for you with your passwords. So we're going to do that, you think?
It's a good possibility. We're going to a new campground tomorrow, and we'll see what kind of connection they have.
But, you always say that. You always say that. Like, it'll be better tomorrow, but it never is.
I'm just a sunny day tomorrow, looking forward type of person, I suppose.
So we were talking earlier on the telephone and talking about ancient technology, and by ancient I mean from about 20 years ago. And we had a good chat about that. We were talking about your first computer. Tell us about your first computer or word processor.
Oh, my. I had an old IBM 8088. It ran DOS. And I had the word programming software I had was called 8-in-1.
Aiding and abetting one. It's the Liberty podcast, the Liberty software.
Yeah. And it was very archaic. It was very clumsy. But it was, you know, a ton better than a typewriter. But it was still very bad. The first time I got a hold of Microsoft Word, I was blown away by it.
Yeah, now they want to make Microsoft Word subscription only, which means you have to keep paying for it, and Bill Gates can see all your data.
Yay.
Yep. You know, he is a friend of the federal government. He was not at one point. I mean, I remember him standing up to Congress and saying, "You can't tell me what to do. I'm more powerful than you are," basically. But he's cozy with them now. He's a one-worlder.
Yeah, money changes everything.
Well, he had a lot back then, but they were threatening his money. They were trying to get him on monopolistic practices, which I don't like to stick up for Microsoft, but I don't really feel like it was that monopolistic simply including that browser. But, you know, I guess they did some other things that were kind of mean and forceful and monopolistic. Who knows? I don't even think that should be a crime in a real world, but
I don't even use Word nowadays. I use a free program called Jarta that, to me, it does everything I need it to do very, very well, and I don't even need Word.
I was talking about having you fax things to me today. We were joking about it, but actually Lou Rockwell talks about how he used to love waking up in the morning in the 70s and having a 30-page fax from Murray Rothbard of his latest screed. And the so-called Patriot movement, the constitutionalist gun people that kind of really started gaining steam right before the first assault, scary weapons ban rifle under Clinton, They communicated by fax, you know, pre-internet.
Yeah, I was watching one of these old-time TV shows the other day, and they had a mimeograph machine. They were, handling the, you know, how you had, like, that big roller thing that you had to crank, and you feed it slides of paper.
Oh, yeah,
and ink everywhere.
I remember wanting one when I was about 11. I really wanted one. We had them in school, and the mimeograph paper has always smelled really interesting to me. You don't have technology that has interesting smells so much anymore.
That's true.
Yeah, the first computer I had was a 8086 like yours. It was an OEI XT IBM clone, and it was in 1991. Which Windows 3.1, Windows was already out, but I didn't have it. I had this old computer that did not have a mouse, couldn't get on the internet. I wanted to get on the internet. I mean, I knew people on it in 91 on the pre-web internet, but I didn't know how to get on it. I was still using drugs until 94, but I was writing a novel on drugs, about drugs. It's my first novel. It's Starvating Company, Beautiful Women. It's you can download it somewhere or buy a used paperback from the first printing. Where, you know, it wasn't printed on demand. It was like I went to a print shop and paid them $4,000 to print and bind 1,000 copies of it. But, yeah, you were saying you had the same type machine, and you said when you finally got on Windows and were able to cut and paste things, it blew you away. But I could actually cut and paste on that. It was, I don't know if you knew you could do that. It was a lot of work. You had to, like, you know, use the down button and get, or the up button and get to the top of where you wanted to cut. And then hold down a function key and then scroll down and not go too far. And then at the end of the paragraph, stop and then hit another function key to cut and then go to where you wanted to go with the down key and insert and then do another function key to paste and then another function key to save. And it always did weird things and didn't always do what it was supposed to. And then you had a view codes key, which would show you a different pane, which would show you the really arcane programming type codes in WordPerfect DOS version, and you could troubleshoot what you did wrong. And you had to have a book that was about 5 inches thick to look those codes up in.
Yeah, I got mine, my 8088, I got for free, and I had no documentation of any kind with it. And other than briefly using an Apple in the late 80s, an Apple P2C. Other than that, I had no computer experience at all. So it would boot up, and I had to figure out what to do from there. And it took me probably 6 months to get to where I could use the computer at all. But by the time I got done with it, I was getting on the internet. But back then, you had two choices for the internet. You could go through services like AOL, or you could do what I was doing, which was
news groups.
I would randomly dial university phone numbers at the University of Northern Nevada, or University of Nevada in Reno, rather. Anyway, I would randomly dial on the computer phone numbers at the university until I would hit a computer that was on a phone line.
War dialing. They call that war dialing.
Yeah, and then I would use this 8-in-1 program to try to get a protocol established with it and then get into their system like that. Which was probably totally illegal.
Did you use a protocol called Gopher?
I'm not sure. It was built into the 8-in-1 program that I had, so I'm not sure what it was.
I used to go to the library in San Francisco, the main library, and they had some computers there, some green screen ones. And in about 92, 93, I would go in there and use their DOS terminals to connect with Gopher websites, which were pre-web, kind of really slowly searchable. You know, you could find different university sites that had different documents and things. And I got on the web the first time in like 94. There was actually a web cafe. It was a web restaurant in San Francisco at 9th and Folsom. And I forget what it's called. It was called like Bites and Bites, you know, B-I-T-E-S and B-Y-E-T-E-S or something like that. And they was a nice, kind of nice restaurant. And they had a few computer terminals. And then they had big screens on the wall which would show what you're looking at on the computer. So there was no privacy, and it was kind of nice. like performance art, and that was the point.
Oh, my.
And then I got on, a Windows 3.1 used for my sister computer with like, you know, 256 megs of RAM or 500K of RAM in like 96, and immediately put up a website at kittyfeet.com, which is the same domain that this is going to go up, which is now the Anarchy Gumbo podcast, but was sort of my blog before blogging software existed. I would like have something to say, and I would, you know, download the HTML file and add to it and then upload it with some images. And that was my blog starting in 96.
This is kind of like old men sitting around saying, I remember the war. It's not, we had to ride to Germany in a ship.
It's not kind of like that. It's exactly like that. This is a couple old men talking about things that young people don't care about and take for granted. Actually, when social networking started, it kind of irked me because then a lot of idiots got on. And before that, it was like people, you had to be kind of smart to get on because it was kind of hard, except for AOL, which I stayed away from. But actually, I remember when MySpace came out. I was on MySpace before it was a social network. Initially, and the reason it was called MySpace, it was a file storage site. And I think that was in, 2000, something like that. But I was on there. And then I remember like they sent an email out to all the people on it and said, we're going to do this thing where you can talk to other people. Click here if you'd like to sign up. And I was like, yeah, okay. And I did. And it was 2003. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what it was. It was my space. It was your space to store files is why they called it that. And it's actually still around, which is surprising to me. Somebody sent me a link the other day for their band, and I went to MySpace, and I was like, that thing still exists?
Yeah. Back to the other metaphor. It's like going and visiting the Queen Mary.
Ah, yes, in Santa Monica.
Yeah. I don't know. Is it still there? I thought they were going to move it.
I don't know, but I think that'd be more fun. At least they rent that out for private parties. I don't think that social networks are any kind of party, and I've left all of them. Well, I left Facebook.
So after listening to your Dick Dale series of interviews,
man,
I have
you're,
to ask,
you're really behind on your podcasts, aren't you? That was
that was a long time ago.
Okay. Go on.
But they were still good. They were excellent. If you haven't heard the Dick Dale interviews, you have to.
Well, the first one's excellent, the second one's good, and the third one's really weird.
And the third one is the one I was going to reference. Speaking of the Queen Mary, it's supposed to be haunted.
Oh, yeah.
What's your opinion on that?
I don't really have an opinion on that. I don't care. I don't know. I don't know if I believe in the possibility of hauntings, man. I don't know. I believe I'm basically a deist religiously. And, that's my religion is not religion, but not atheist and not agnostic. You know, I think there's something that created everything, wound it up, and then walked away to smoke a cigar for a few billion years and watch it and laugh. Not necessarily laugh at it, but just kind of laugh. I used to believe in prayer. I used to believe you could petition the Lord with prayer, but now I really don't think so. And I think that most things that happen on earth, if not all things that happen on earth, are the result of things that happen on earth, not the result of some guy with a long beard sitting on a chair pulling puppet strings in the sky, you know, making sure that your kid doesn't die and your bus comes on time, which are two of the most common prayers people have, I think. I prayed for my kid not to die, and she died anyway, so that kind of made me a deist. And everybody who said, it's God's will, and she's with God now, I wanted to punch. So if you ever deal with somebody who loses a kid, this is not to you, Ben, this is the audience. If you ever deal with someone that loses a kid, don't try to make them feel better by telling them they're with God now if they're not religious, and telling them, and especially don't tell them it's God's will because they may punch you.
Yeah, I was going to add that the other thing that's probably the most common is whether or not your sports team wins this critical game.
Or whether or not you get laid. Yeah. How did we get into that? You asked me about hauntings. Yeah, most people I've met who believe that they've sensed the presence of ghosts in some way are people who have some other, who have some great personality failing or inability to deal with life in some way. That's what I've found. That's my empirical evidence that doesn't prove anything, but that's where it points me.
Yeah, I never really bought all that, even when I was a little kid, and people would try to scare me with ghost stories. It was just like, you know, I didn't see how that could possibly make any sense at all.
However, I do believe that life does not end when your heart stops beating, or not that life doesn't end, but something carries on, you know, and I don't know if it is reincarnated or, I mean, reincarnation, everyone I know who believes in reincarnation, who's not born in the East, every white person I've ever met who believes in reincarnation has even deeper flaws than the people I know who believe in ghosts. But I guess from a physics standpoint, reincarnation would make the most sense. But I don't know what I believe in. But I do believe, and I have believed since I was a very small child and still maintain, that there's something so strong in what I can see in my consciousness and my being alive that I know that it's more than a collection of circuits responding to stimuli. And I know it will continue after my body ceases to be alive somehow. And I don't know what that will be. And I don't know that it'll have the ability to contact my loved ones or scare my enemies. You know, I think if there were ghosts, there'd be a lot more people scared, because I think that, I think the power most people would want as ghosts isn't just to comfort their loved ones, but more to scare their enemies and have superpowers after they're dead and be able to do things they couldn't do while they're alive. And I don't see a lot of that happening.
Yeah, my problem, even when I was a little kid, my problem with the whole, with that whole angle, both ghosts and reincarnation, was the basic math. The basic math doesn't work. You know, if there's ghosts, there's billions of them everywhere. And if there's reincarnation, we have a problem because, you know, the population is increasing at a pace that they're, okay, so what is there? Something generating new in somewhere, and then they're not dying off, and, you know, so in a way,
how do you know they're not? How do you know they're not reincarnating on a different planet?
Well, they could be. And some Eastern thought is that, you know, the slug reincarnates into the butterfly, and the butterfly reincarnates into the squirrel, and the squirrel reincarnates, you know. And so I could kind of see that as maybe making a little bit more sense.
You and I are going to come back as squirrels, because we love squirrels so much.
Yeah, every podcast has to come back to squirrels.
Yeah, because we're old men, and young people don't understand old men's fascination with squirrels. But my thing is basically just the older you get, even if you keep a good attitude about people, more and more people disappoint you over a period of decades. And it's kind of cumulative. And you go, you know, squirrels never disappoint you. They'll bite you if you get too close to them, but you can expect that. Whereas humans will promise you one thing and do another. Kind of like Mayor McCheese, kind of like the governor of Wyoming, Matt Mead, who ran under a platform of, I love guns. Like, Neem and I went and interviewed him, and we have him on film, on YouTube, on the news, saying, you know, I love the Wyoming Firearms Freedom Act, and I support it, and I will go after anyone who violates it as governor. Now that he's governor and they're trying to put an even stronger one through that's similar, he's like, oh, I don't know if we could do that. You know, and basically it's like, he's not only a politician, he was a federal attorney. And, you know, they federal attorneys don't generally look out for the rights of people in any way.
Yeah. You know, I've never been lied to by a squirrel.
That's it. That in the simplest terms, that's why we love squirrels. Yep. They never lie to you.
Yeah. Since we're on this weird topic, or we were, but you wandered us away from it, did I ever tell you about my possible
haunting?
Out-of-body... What?
Haunting?
Oh, no. My possible out-of-body experience, possibly post-mortem, back-to-life type situation that may or may not have happened?
No, but I think we should save the file and go sell some things and come back and let you tell it for 20 or 30 minutes.
That sounds like a good idea, Michael.
All right.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get State Speech is Hate Speech, Anarchy Gumbo, Guns and Weed, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $10 for 5 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
Did your world collapse when Ron Paul didn't win? Don't keep hoping for some great man to fix government through government. Complete your evolution today to full-on anarcho-capitalist. Reward your brain with the Freedom Fiends and quit breaking your heart with some politician. While the libertarians argue,
but who would build the roads?
The Freedom Fiends have already built the roads and moved on to making the great media content of the libertarian paradise. FreedomFiends.com. That's FreedomFiends.com. You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Today we have Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, calling from a rural windowless bunker in rural Wyoming. Alabama. And you're going to tell us a story about your drugged out space cadet youth. Go ahead.
I was in Reno, Nevada in about, 1995. And I was sitting at a red light in my pickup truck, small pickup truck. And a different pickup truck was doing about double the speed limit coming directly towards me in the intersection. But in his lane, I'm in my lane. He ran through the red light, hit cross traffic, which sent him airborne, and he's in one of these big four-wheel drive trucks with the big wheels and the roll bar and the all the metal on front and everything like this, and his truck landed essentially on top of my head. His rear differential actually hit right over my head and drove the cab of my pickup down onto my head, pushed my hips down into the seat hard enough that it dislocated my tailbone by about 3 inches, and gave me a pretty bad concussion and messed up, six vertebrae? No, three vertebrae in my neck and three in my back, and it was uncomfortable. I remember, now, first let me tell you what I remember, and then let me tell you what I think about it. I remember seeing the guy come into the intersection. And I remember thinking, he's going to hit that car. And then everything goes into snapshot. I don't remember it like a rolling movie. I remember it in like little snapshot windows.
Slideshow.
Yeah. And I remember seeing him go airborne. And then the next snapshot that is in my memory is of looking at my windshield laying against my face, because his impact had brought the whole front of the windshield and everything up to my face, and it brought the cab down to my head and kind of like formed it around me, and I didn't have hearing immediately. It took me a second before I had hearing, and then when I had hearing, it was like all the sound rushed in at once, and I remember carefully getting out of my pickup truck, climbing up on top of my pickup truck, looking into his pickup truck, seeing that his arm had a gash in it just below the elbow, and his girlfriend had a bloody nose, and she was screaming at him, yelling at him, and then I thought, okay, I shouldn't move around because this is a pretty bad accident, so I climbed back in and sat back down in the cab of my truck. The problem is that couldn't have happened because then I just sat there. When the emergency people showed up, they had to use the jaws of life to rip the door off the passenger side and come in through the passenger side and pry me out on a back thing and hauled me to the hospital. And I remember as I was in the ambulance and being tended to by the attendant, I remember him saying to the other attendant, "I cannot imagine how this guy is alive." And one of the other firefighters that was there actually told the newspaper reporter that showed up that it looked like everybody was going to survive except the guy in the green truck, and he didn't think I could possibly have survived. That was me. So I got to the hospital, And I was the first one that they took. They actually threw a couple of the walking wounded in the ambulance with me, but I was the first one that they got out of there and got going with. Because they just poured all their attention on getting me out of the truck. And I got to the hospital, and they were asking me how I was, and I told them my neck hurt, and I told them my back hurt, and I had a mouthful of glass.
Ugh.
And I asked if, oh, I'm getting some echo, but I'll talk faster. Anyway, I asked if the kid was okay because of how bad the gash in his arm was, and the nurse that I was asking said, oh, he'll be fine, it's just a scratch. And then when they eventually let me out, because I was banged up pretty good, but I still got out that night. And as I was walking out of the hospital, I saw the driver of the truck, and I recognized him, and I started walking towards him. And his arm was bandaged up, and he was with his girlfriend. And he clearly had no idea who I was and hadn't seen me before or anything. But it kind of scared him because this guy is walking toward him. And he knew I was one of the victims, and he had caused it. And then it dawned on me that I could not have seen him before because there's no way I could have climbed out of that truck. So now I have here this possible out-of-body experience, except I don't believe it. I believe what happened was I projected that memory back onto the situation through a hallucination that took place when I got whacked in the head. And in the hours after the head injury, my thinking was so confused that, like the next day or whatever, when I started to put together what had happened, my damaged brain put together the sequence in the wrong series, and I imagined that climbing out of the truck and looking at the kid. And I have to believe that because my only other option is to believe that I had an out-of-body experience. And I don't believe in out-of-body experiences. What do you think about that?
Wow. Is it possible that while the car accident was happening, out of the corner of your eye, you saw his vehicle, didn't remember it, and then saw a wounded guy in the same vehicle at the hospital and just connected that it was him?
I could have. In the damaged state that my brain was at the time, I could have sewn together any kind of scenario.
I mean, that's...
it could have been just... Go ahead.
That's the easy explanation for me, and that I was thinking while you were saying it. I know that people do have extraordinary experiences when they face death in the moment, because I've had one, but there was nothing really metaphysical about it. Mine was, I was a passenger in a car. There was one person driving, and I was in the front in the passenger seat. We both had seatbelts on. We were driving on the 5 near Glendale, California, on a beautiful sunny afternoon, kind of early rush hour, like 3:30 p.m., which is definitely after the start of rush hour in LA, so it wasn't wall to wall cars and people were still going, 60, 55, 60. But there was enough space between the cars that there was room for things to happen. And, the chick driving, she was actually an intern on my first movie. That was back when I was willing to work with other people. I don't do it much now, except for select people like you and Nima and DJ. But back then I was like, oh, that's what you do. You go on Craigslist, you get interns, people in college, and you work it out with their teacher to give them college credit to help you with stuff. And she was driving somewhere to do something for my first movie. And she failed to look at something, and somebody merged and she didn't see him, and they tapped the back of her car. And we went into a spin, and we spun around 3 complete times and went over 3 lanes of traffic and came to a stop without anybody hitting us, came to a complete stop on the side of the road facing the opposite direction. And I remember very vividly the, 3 or 4 seconds that happened. I had a number of thoughts in my head. None of them were metaphysical, and my life did not flash before my eyes. I had 3 thoughts. One was, don't grab the wheel, because my immediate instinct was to reach over and grab her wheel and try to correct it. And that probably would have gotten us killed. And that's since become a real kind of lesson for me in life of not trying to control everything. Like, don't grab the wheel in every situation. And the other thoughts that went through my head were kind of acceptance. And one was, I may end up dead, and I accept that. And the second thought that came immediately after was, I probably won't end up dead, but I may end up in the hospital in a body cast for a year. And I accepted that. And then by the time those three thoughts were done being processed, we were on the side of the road, relatively safe, facing the opposite direction. That was my, wow, my near-death experience. But I took a lot away from it that I still keep in me. One is, don't grab the wheel. And the other is, be prepared to accept any eventuality and don't panic about it.
That's pretty important, actually.
I mean, that's the closest probably to a metaphysical experience I've had in my life. And there was nothing, you know, that I felt external. I mean, a lot of people would say and have told me that was, you know, the hand of God reaching down and telling me not to grab the wheel and keeping me from grabbing the wheel and giving me the acceptance. But as far as I know, it came from within my head and within my, you know, own process.
The human brain is an amazing thing.
Yeah, it is. So is the squirrel brain.
Roll around. more ways. But there's all kinds of chemicals that roll around in there and do all kinds of weird things. I heard you and Nima one talking about that paralyzation that takes place or fails to take place when you're asleep. That's kind of in the same realm, because it's still, you know, the ability of your mind to try to control everything that's around it, whether it has control or not.
Yeah, and with a lot of things that people consider maladies, like that thing Nima was describing of, you know, waking up and not being able to move for a minute, you know, and like so-called chemical imbalances that doctors try to treat with magical drugs made by large pharmaceutical companies that, you know, humanity got along with for thousands of years without those drugs and probably did better. I think humanity's more screwed up now than it's ever been as a whole in a lot of ways. But I kind of don't necessarily look at those as maladies. I look for the, what is the body trying to do there? Because a lot of things evolutionarily seem to be survival mechanisms. And maybe that is some sort of either residual survival mechanism or a new one evolving. I just can't figure out what it would be. What would be the advantage of waking up paralyzed? But, you know, maybe tricking lions into thinking you're dead. I don't know.
I think it has more to do with not acting out a dream when you're asleep and killing your spouse accidentally because you think she's a lion.
Well, there are people that do a version of sleepwalking that's more like sleep strangling. I've heard of that. So maybe that is. I don't like to think of Nima as someone who would sleep strangle, and I've never had any evidence to think he is. But yeah, maybe.
Because I have dreams where quite frequently, I say quite frequently.
Hey, hang on. This is the Republicans calling me. Let's take this. Hang on. Hello? Hey, Derek J. Hang on a sec. Let me put Ben Quaker on hold. Hey, Ben. Ben, let me stop.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
You know, a while back you said something about, I said slideshow, because you were talking about something that looked like, you know, you looked at something as a slideshow. And then I was realizing that kind of ties back with our original premise here about ancient technology. It's kind of interesting to me, when you and I say slideshow, we probably picture something different than most of our audience pictures, younger people. Younger people probably picture some flash presentation on the web, where pictures are streaming by and there's tinkling piano music playing in the background. But the term slideshow and sort of what that technology is imitating comes from this thing people used to do before the internet for entertainment, which was you would take pictures on your vacation with a 35 millimeter camera. You'd send the film off to be developed. You'd pay a bunch of money. The film was basically plastic coated with photosensitive silver chemical, silver compounds, and you'd pay a bunch of money for the film and the camera and the developing. And a week later, you'd get prints back, but you could also have slides made, which were little, about 2x2 inch cardboard frames, which held a like 1.5x1 inch piece of transparent film, and you would stick it in this machine called a slide machine, and it had a carousel to, you know, which was a round sort of magazine, like a drum magazine on a rifle. You'd have this magazine called a carousel of, you know, about 80 slides, and you'd invite people over, you'd make drinks, you'd put on some music, you wouldn't take off your clothes necessarily, but then you'd play the slideshow, and you'd stand up with the little controller on the wire and press the button, and you'd tell what's going on in it. And then when you're done or people were bored or leaving, you'd hit the button and go to the next slide, which kind of is imitated in a PowerPoint presentation. If you've ever seen the dog and pony show that salesmen and government employees use to sell the Iraq war or the latest dishwasher, if they're private sector, use a presentation like that. It's called a PowerPoint presentation, and that's also imitating slideshow. Do you remember slideshows? Did you ever do those?
Oh, yeah. When I was a little kid, my mom and dad had a real good friend from their childhood who had basically spent his life going around the world photographing everything, and he had hours and hours and hours of just sitting there in the living room, the lights off, this projection up on the wall, and him saying, you know, this is when I was in Taiwan. This is what people dress like in South Korea. This is what people look like in India. And it was almost magical to us.
It was kind of like the internet in your living room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is like 1965. So we were thrilled by it. It was better than TV.
Yeah. A lot of computer technology imitates old analog technology because that would make sense. You want to do something in a better way, in a cheaper way that's can be shared with more people, but you need sort of a motif and an interface to base it on, like slideshows, like the way search engines work. A lot of times it's based on how a card catalog in a library worked, which I don't even know if they have anymore, but that was a big sort of table with little drawers in it that would pull out, and you'd have, you know, you'd have the A ones, the B ones, the C ones, and you'd look something up by topic, author, subject, name, author, and then you'd get the Dewey Decimal System number, and then you'd go searching in the shelves in the library for that book based on the number.
And the Dewey Decimal System, by the way, was devised by a guy named Dewey, who hated everybody and wanted people dead, and if he couldn't get them dead, he'd drive them crazy with his Dewey Decimal System.
Did he really want people dead?
He was a eugenist, yeah. He was a very evil progressive.
It would make sense somehow that someone who invented a hard-to-use but the only one at the time cataloging system for, you know, a building full of books would be into eugenics, because in his mind, he was sorting and cataloging with statistics that he believed, you know, the different races and the different types of people and probably the different phrenology, brain pan sizes and shapes. Who knows?
Yeah, I would imagine he probably believed in phrenology. Yep.
I have notes to call a Freedom Fiends episode. You can't spell statistics without statist. And it's true, and they actually derive from the same word. State derives from the same word that statistics derive from.
So we went from spooky goblins and ghosts all the way to the Dewey Decimal System. That's like all the way around the world there.
Well, I used to think that my library was haunted when I was a kid. I used to have the library in Westfield, New York, the James Patterson Library. Oh, wait, is Patterson? Yeah, Prendergast is in Jamestown. The James Patterson Library in Westfield, New York, is a stunning library for a town of 3,000 people. It's an amazing library, and a lot of it's done with private donations of a fund of some rich family, the Patterson family. So it's, you know, they're not as tax eatery as most libraries are, but it's a giant library with a great collection, and it's really old, but it's well maintained, and it's all marble inside. And they also had things other than books, like they had multimedia stuff. You could check out a carousel of slides of someone's African vacation or safari. You could check out, the coolest thing was they had a large collection of taxidermied small animals under glass, and you could check them out. I'd check out the fox and have it in my home for 2 weeks, and then check out the squirrel, and then check out the crow. Not the movie The Crow. I would check out a crow, not a movie, not a book. Yeah, but the library kind of had a real, it was so big for such a small town library that you could actually get lost in it. And there were a lot of rooms that there wouldn't be another person in. And I would kind of feel when I was in those rooms, a presence of someone else when they weren't in there. And it was kind of a loving presence. It was kind of a, like, you know, it was like the ghost of the librarian, the friendly librarian past or something. And I don't, you know, my logical brain now says that probably wasn't the dead librarian who originally worked there, but it was probably the sort of spiritual feeling that I've always gotten from physical books. Like I have this, this feeling, since I was a little kid, I would kind of fetishize books and pet them and stroke them and consider them more than the sum of the words in them and imagine that the authors led these grand lives, and I wanted to be an author when I grew up, and that's why I became an author. And, you know, I basically had two childhood dreams, or three childhood dreams. One is to be a book author, a published successful book author, which I've done and I'm kind of bored with and don't really want to do anymore. One is to reach the world from my bedroom, which was why I was interested in ham radio early on. But, you know, we're doing that right now. We're reaching the world from my bedroom. And the third one is to be a radio host and talk. They didn't really, I guess they had talk radio then, but there wasn't a lot of it that I heard. But I wanted to talk on the radio, actual radio, not this internet stuff, which didn't exist then. But I wanted to be on the radio, and the Fiends are in the process of getting on the radio and getting slowly syndicated across the country. So, you know, within a year or two, we'll get on the radio in less than a year or two, but then we have to get stations to take us. So it'll probably take a few years to get a bunch of stations. So within a few years, all my life goals will be met, and that's a good thing.
That's pretty good. If a person can get, you know, half or, you know, two-thirds through their life and having accomplished that, that's quite an accomplishment.
And
most people don't.
And it's probably good. I'm 48 now, you know, so by 50, I'll have achieved all my life goals, which is probably better than achieving them all by 22, which a lot of people do, because a lot of people that achieve their life goals by 22 end up really screwed up and disappointed after that, because there's really nowhere to go from then. And, you know, so I basically spent my youth intoxicated and chasing women, which was a distraction, which allowed me to get some life experience under my belt and mature or immature, however you want to look at it, to the point where it's good that I'm going to be reaching my life goals at 50.
Yeah.
Although I have this fear that we'll get on a bunch of radio stations, and then Obama will outlaw talk radio, which I think he will. He's going after the Second Amendment, and then he'll go after the First. He's already killed the Fourth and the Tenth and a few other ones. So,
I never really had a whole lot of life goals as a kid. I wanted to have as much fun as possible, and never in any way conceived of the possibility of living past 30.
Yeah.
So I did. I thought, you know, if there's something that seems fun, if it's, you know, surfing, riding motorcycles way too fast, just whatever pops into my head that sounds like it'd be fun, let's do it. And because, you know, there's no tomorrow. There's no way I'm going to last, so let's burn it out. And the downside of that is I destroyed my body, and I'm still around.
Yeah. I thought I'd be dead by 30. It was actually a plan because all my heroes were dead by 30 back then, you know. or not much after 30. You know, Edgar Allan Poe. Who else were my heroes? I mean, this is way before Kurt Cobain. You know, Janis, Jimmy, people like that.
Jim
Morrison. Yeah, all my heroes were dead by 27. And I don't know, how old was Poe when he died? Not old.
Yeah, not much past that.
And Syd Barrett was alive, but fat and crazy, which seemed okay. That seemed doable. Oh,
he was alive on a technical sense.
Yeah, Poe died at age 40.
Ah.
Broke and penniless and alcoholic in Baltimore, which is one of the worst places to live, let alone die. So, you know, his room, I used to live in Charlottesville, Virginia, which interestingly, that city just became the first city to outlaw drones, and their city council did it, which is pretty mind-blowing to me because, I mean, there's all this nullification going on, states trying to pass things that supersede the federal government, which is good. And it also just shows the immense level at which the slaves are not happy anymore. And I'm really surprised that the city council of Charlottesville, Virginia, where I used to live, passed this. Because first of all, it's pretty rare now for liberals to go against Obama. You know, when Bush was tapping all your phones and bombing, droning brown people, the liberals were all screaming about it. But now that their dear leader Obama is doing it, they're all for it, and not many of them are making a peep. And Charlottesville was founded by Jefferson, but it's an incredibly one-worldly nanny kind of town. I mean, the local newspaper is called the Daily Progress, if that gives you an idea of how these progressives think. But the city council passed a law against drones, which probably won't keep federal drones out, but it will keep local agencies like the sheriff from being able to get drones, which I like. So good for them. But Charlottesville, Virginia, UVA, University of Virginia, Edgar Allan Poe went there, and he was kicked out of the school in disgrace for gambling debts and opium, and later became famous and died. And they decided to make his room into a museum. And there's glass in front of the room. You know, you can walk by in the quad. You know, there's a bunch of rooms off the quad where the, like, special seniors with lots of money get to live, because there's only about, you know, 40 rooms there. So they get those rooms. But Edgar Allan Poe's room is glassed off. DJ and I went and looked at it last time we were there. And you look in and there's, first of all, the room is immaculate, which I really doubt a gambling, alcoholic, opium addict, insane person would have kept his room. The bed's made. There's no empty tins of opium or whiskey bottles on the floor. And there's a little writing desk that has a quill pen. And there is a stuffed raven in the corner. And it's just this ridiculous wax museum kind of version of him being deified after they kicked him out in disgrace. And then he went and made something of himself despite them.
When you were describing earlier going to the library and checking out
beasts,
you know, animals that, I was thinking of the word macabre, but now you're talking about Poe's room like that. And it's kind of the same macabre setting. Did I lose you?
No, I'm here. I had to get something. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking how to preserve the room like that as a shrine is kind of the same macabre thinking as taking all these animals and skinning them and making a fake skeleton for them and then stretching the skin back over the wire skeleton and keeping it in your room.
Yeah, except this is legal. Yeah.
Well, you can't do that with, you couldn't do that with Poe anyway, with all that alcohol and heroin. He wasn't in very good shape.
He'd explode. He'd spontaneously combust with all that heroin and alcohol. Yeah. Yeah. Good times.
I don't know. It must preserve pretty good. I mean, look at Keith Richards.
Yeah. He said that, no doctor will ever admit it, but heroin is a cure for the common cold. And I agree. It was my experience 25 years ago.
Are you cured, or you just don't care that you have it?
I don't know. Neither. Well, you don't care that you have it, but you also don't ever have any symptoms of it until you stop using, and then you have symptoms of a cold, even if you don't have a cold.
Yeah, then according to how long you've been, you know, how many cycles through, you get hit with that many cycles of cold.
Yeah.
All in the same couple days.
Good times.
Although I have to interject that I have never actually used heroin. I have had lots of opiates in medication form, and I've sold lots of heroin, but I never actually used heroin.
Well,
statute of limitations, by the way.
You know what I think about heroin is that it should be legal and available to school children in vending machines as long as the vending machines are privately owned and operated.
And it probably wouldn't be used any more than it is today, and possibly even less.
Yeah. Well, let's go sell some more things and then come back for our last bit of Ben Wonderfulness.
Okay.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
So, Ben, where are you and what are you looking at?
I am in a campground, and I just wandered down to the other side where I haven't been walking. The whole podcast, I've been walking around the campground. And now I'm in a new section that I haven't walked in tonight, and I'm literally surrounded by squirrels. There's probably 15 squirrels within visual range of me.
Awesome.
And one of them is probably 20 feet away, and he's just looking at me like, what are you going to do?
Awesome. I quoted you recently on a Freedom Fiends, partially because I was really touched by what you said, and partially because you're not putting up episodes, so I got to keep you out there. So I did. I was talking about how you and I were talking on the phone, and you were walking in the woods, and you said, you know, Michael, I would rather just walk in the woods the rest of my life than do all this work to do these podcasts and put myself out there and take chances at, you know, people not liking what I do or whatever, but I'd rather just walk through the woods the rest of my life, but I have to do that. And Nima was really touched by that too. He thought that was heavy, and I thought that was really heavy too.
Yeah, I came to this conclusion. Actually, I was in my garden, just working in my garden in my backyard, and I realized that I can't just sit on this body of information. I have to get it out of my head. I have to spread it, and I have to say these things in my head because, for whatever reason, morally or just crazy pressure or whatever, I feel obliged. You know, I've lived a really good life. In ways, it's been very dangerous. It's been exciting.
You've been shot twice.
Yeah, actually hit twice. I've been shot at several times. And it's been a really good life. And I was content to just retire into my garden and, you know, have comfort and never have any more confrontation and never have any more, you know, presentations and never have to do any of those things. And there I was in my garden and I thought, I can't do that. I have to get this stuff out of my head. I have to share it. And if I don't, I know that I'm robbing people by keeping it to myself.
I don't know about robbing people, but I think there is a big power to giving back. And you can't do that necessarily to the people that gave to you because they might not still be around or might not want what you have back or might not need what you have, but you have to give it back to other people. And I think that you and I are kind of, I hesitate to use the word blessed, but really, really lucky. I mean, we've worked really hard to do what we do, but we also are really lucky to have found an audience. And a lot of the audience is people half our age. And I think that's something that's missing a lot in current society is young people being mentored and taught by older people in a non-academic setting. It used to be, you know, old people were revered. I'm not saying, those kids don't appreciate me, because they do appreciate me. But, you know, it used to be there was a lot more like, I mean, even in an organized sense, like Boy Scouts, you know, like an older person would take a younger person out and teach him something and hopefully not molest him. You know, when I was young, I used to hang out with these guys. When I was like 10, I'd hang out with these guys that were like 70. Somebody just pigeoned me. You're the coolest 48-year-old I've ever met. Was surprised to hear your age on the show. That's pretty awesome. But, you know, it used to be there was a lot more contact between older people and younger people. And now I think with the internet and the face pages and the finger tagging on the face space, young people just hang out with young people and they end up kind of doing more dumb young people stuff and doing things that they think are activism that aren't, and doing things that are activism, but in a really wrong direction, like trying to get the government to point guns at people to get things done and right wrongs supposedly. But, what do you think about all that?
I think that's dead on. You know, it used to be a day when everybody would gather around the campfire and the elders would tell stories. They would tell, you know, morals, how they developed the moral-based stories. And they would pass on these things from generation to generation. And the old people actually served a function. And now, you know, I hate to say this, I'm in a campground full of mostly retired people, and there's so much wisdom here. There's so much intelligence. But most of it is going to die with these people because of that separation that you're talking about. In days gone by, they would have their grandchildren on their knee.
Yeah. Well, I think that's as good a place as any to end. Unless you have any closing pithy statements for the Utes out there, the young Utes.
When I was your age, we were zero copying pamphlets and handing them.
I was, man. I got in trouble in seventh grade for putting out an underground newspaper anonymously.
I believe that
in school. I didn't use mimeograph. I went and spent 5 cents a page. It was a one page document, and I went and made the copies at the Patterson Library.
Good times.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, man. It's been really cool, Ben, having you on.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Michael.
Thanks for being had. Say worms.
Worms.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.